Our next speaker is Dr. Avanti Nehruvi of the Roehampton University in London. She will talk on temple texts and cultural performances in South Asia.
While they have asked for a projector, firstly, I want to thank the Shivadasini coordinators for giving me this opportunity to speak today to you and share with you my work. Briefly, I trained dancer in Bharatanatyam and Kuchipudi since childhood in India. Then I went to America. I got my PhD there from the Department of Performance Studies. And I taught at UCLA and in the other Department of Performance Studies at Northwestern University. And recently, I've taken up this post at Roehampton, where I'm the convener of the first MA in South Asian Dance Studies, I believe. So what I will do today is first show you some visuals and then shut them out and then take you to the archive, as it were, the performance archive. I'm going to talk about Devadasis. This is Bala Saraswati, the great performer. She herself was part of the, belonged to the hereditary Devadasi community. This is Gauri Amma, who was also one of the early Devadasi dancers. This is Rukmini Devi Arundel, who I've been speaking about, and she was the first Brahmin woman to learn the dance. And she was also a theosophist, which was married to her English husband, George Sidney Arundel, who was the third president of the Theosophical Society in India. This is Rukmini Devi when she was old, 80, just before she died, 84. This is Rukmini Devi's sort of reimagining of the dancing body. This is herself in 1935, the new look she created, the costumes, the jewelry, all of this which you see today in the Bharatanatyam dance performance. There's another image of her. I'm going to run through these images because I want to talk with you, and then that's she again, all those lines you see. This is the Kalakshetra institution that she established in 1935. It's a world-renowned institution, it's a national institution today, and this is the where the students are trained. It's a multidisciplinary institution. They're also trained in Bharatanatyam. And this is the aesthetic that she developed, the anti-colonial aesthetic. Vulgarity, art without vulgarity, education without fear, something like that. And this is the temple theatre that she built for the dance just before she died in 1984. And I want to talk about this whole notion of the temple and how it sort of emerged as an epistemological and historical idea in the dance performance, as a concept metaphor, as it were. I'm going to rush through this. I want to. I don't need this. In this paper, I will describe how the temple emerged as a historical trope and as an epistemological metaphor in the social dramas and cultural performances of Bharatanatyam in the 1920s. Drawing on Victor Turner, Milton Singer, thank you, and Richard Schechner's theories of social dramas and cultural performances, I will show how the social dramas associated with Dr. Muthulakshmi Reddy's 1927 legislative bill to ban Devadasi dedications in Hindu temples foregrounded the Hindu temple as a historical site for social reform. Devadasis, however, protested Reddy's legislation by repressing the transgressive dimensions of their social lives and suggested instead that the true purpose of their dance was religion and service, and that they were associated with the mutts and temples throughout the length and breadth of the Madras presidency. In the 1930s, Rukmini Devi Arundel, T. Bala Saraswati, and V. Raghavan, the well-known scholar of Indian performing arts, took their cue from Devadasis and idealized not the Devadasi, the temple dancer, but the temple itself, and projected it as a spiritual and architectural source for Bharatanatyam performance. T. Bala Saraswati, belonging herself to the Devadasi lineage, allegorized the form of Bharatanatyam in the metaphor of the temple, and by saying that the Bharatanatyam dance recital is structured like a great temple. Rukmini Devi allegorized Bharatanatyam by creating a temple stage setting and positioning the known hereditary dancer, herself in this case within this stage setting. And V. Raghavan, the great Sanskrit scholar, described Bharatanatyam from within the context of temple worship and ritual. Two women and a man, in other words, worked collaboratively, allegorized Sadir as Bharatanatyam, and crafted a temple stage aesthetic for classical Bharatanatyam between 1930 and 1980. Walter Benjamin explains that to articulate the past historically does not mean to recognize it the way it really was. It means to seize hold of a memory as it flashes up at a moment of danger, end quote. To rescue a dance tradition stigmatized within the colonial and national discourses of temple prostitution in the 1930s, Rukmini Devi projected a modern temple stage and offered it as an alternative allegorical structure to rescue the dance. The theatrical structure was redemptive in that it was able to rescue from oblivion an elaborate court and ritual repertoire which could not be danced within the precincts of the Hindu temple because of its alleged association with temple prostitution in the 1930s. Rukmini Devi's temple stage, in other words, did more in that it imprinted this historical moment of danger in the social and political imaginary of the dance. The temple stage, in other words, enabled dancers and scholars to speak about the historical breach of the anti-Notch social reform movement, which I'll speak about later, as representing a national trauma inaugurated by the arrival of British colonialism in India. In this way, the aesthetic history of 20th century Bharatanatyam was always already linked to the political history of the Hindu temple, to Indian nationalism and British colonialism, and this history was displayed dramatically in each and every public performance realized on Rukmini Devi's temple stage. Scholars discussing Indian classical dance do so from within two dominant models. One is the cultural performance model articulated by Milton Singer and V. Raghavan, and the other is the Indian classical dance paradigm articulated by V. Raghavan and Kapila Vatsyayam. While the two paradigms facilitated discussions about the multilingual plurality of Indian performance traditions and practices, neither could discuss the allegorical historicity and modernity of classical Bharatanatyam constituted around the theatrical allegorization of the Hindu temple as temple stage. Both paradigms idealized Indian dance forms within cultural and aesthetic categories, but neither could engage with issues revolving around social history, memory, historiography, pertaining specifically to the Hindu temple, which helped constitute Bharatanatyam as a socio-historical and a socio-cultural representation in the 20th century. So it is this social history around the temple and in the performance of Bharatanatyam that I want to share with you today. What I'm saying is that it was the metaphor of the Hindu temple which enabled the historicization of 20th century Bharatanatyam and other classical forms, including Kathak, Odissi, and Satriya as classical forms. The temple thus manifested itself not just as a pan-Indian and South Asian cultural concept, but also informs the diasporic production of Bharatanatyam in the US, UK, Canada, and Australia. While Bharatanatyam taught and performed in temples in the UK today, in India the dance is performed in temple venues during festivals. In community-centered performances in the UK and the US, the temple continues to impinge on the consciousness of the spectator as he, she observes the stylized gestures of ritualized supplication and devotion to the signposts of Indian culture, including God, Guru, and temple, which the classical dancer performs on the global stage today. Even when the dancer does not perform these gestures, as is common practice today in the globalized economy in which the dance circulates, the temple is foregrounded in the imagination of the spectator because the classical repertoire features God as hero. Yet it was Devadasis, or temple dancers, who first recognized the political use of the temple as a concept metaphor and used it to mobilize their community and to insert themselves into the national and international debates of British colonialism and Indian nationalism in 1927. I will now tell that other protest story albeit briefly, as a way to provide a historical context for our temple discussion and then discuss Rukmini Devi's dance revival realized in the theatrical metaphor of the temple stage. Briefly, the South Indian Hindu temple emerged as an endangered political concept in the anti-Nautch social reform movement of the 1890s. This simmering 19th century social drama was recharged dramatically on November 24, 1927, the year when Dr. Muthulakshmi Reddy, a well-known doctor, social worker, and activist working on behalf of Indian women's movement, proposed a bill in the Madras Legislative Council to stop the practice of dedicating young girls to Hindu temples. In her speech, Reddy said, and I quote, "Now the appellation of the Devadasi, as everyone knows here, whatever the original meaning might have been, stands for prostitute. In South India, a girl may marry a tree, an arrow, or an idol, which generally implies that she has become a prostitute," end quote. She went on to explain that the practice of dedication was worse than drink, as it promoted the spread of venereal diseases, the corruption of the young people and husbands, and increased perversities, end quote. "In the cause of humanity," she said, "and justice, we can no longer delay this piece of legislation, a reform by which we can rescue thousands of young, innocent children from a life of immorality and vice, from suffering diseases and death resulting from infection with venereal diseases," end quote. Reddy proposed this bill as a way to deal with the public humiliation caused by the publication of Catherine Mayo's book Mother India in 1927, in which Devadasis were stigmatized as the priest's own prostitute. Even Mahatma Gandhi had to respond to this book. In his article entitled The Drain Inspector's Report, Gandhi said, and I quote, that while I consider this book to be unfit to be placed before Americans and Englishmen, it is a book that every Indian can read with profit, end quote. But it was Gandhi, actually, who made the connection between God, nation, and women when he met with Devadasis in 1927. And I quote, "When I met a few Devadasis this afternoon," Gandhi said, "and was engaged in conversation with them, my whole soul rebelled against the institution. We commit a double crime when we use our sisters for our lust, and that in the name of God, for we call them Devadasis. In calling them Devadasis, we insult God himself in the sacred name of religion, and we commit a double crime that we take these sisters of ours to serve our lust and take in the same breath the name of God," end quote. Devadasis objected strenuously to their demonization as prostitutes in 1927, and they wrote letters in English language and submitted them to the Madras Legislative Council. I'm going to just focus on one letter, the C.P. Ramaswamy Iyer Memorial, which contained 20 paragraphs that included quotations from religious texts. In these memorials, Devadasis compared themselves to sannyasins who preside over mutts with both Buddhist and Roman, and akin themselves, likened themselves with both Buddhist and Roman Catholic nuns. They described, and I'm quoting, the Devadasi dedication ceremony, which resembled a Brahmin marriage, as a way of making a commitment to God. The Devadasis claimed that we marry none but God and that God alone is our Lord and Master. As a man ties a thali around the neck of his wife as a symbol of wedlock, we go to the temple and symbolically associate the thali or puttu tied around our necks by the old God Mighty himself. They claimed that this idea was not new. They cited the devotional songs of Devaram, of the Shaivite Acharyas, and the texts of the Vaishnavite Alvars. Raising the issue of religious and political rights, Devadasis asserted that any legislation that prevented performance of their religious rights constituted a violation of their religious freedom. They praised the principle of religious freedom granted to our land in the proclamation of the great Queen Victoria, whose words, and I'm quoting, are considered, they said, even today as the Magna Charta of India, whose message is so noble in its spirit and magnificently just that it has won the eternal gratitude and unflinching loyalty of her Indian subjects. In my doctoral thesis, I marked this moment of 1927 as a moment of departure in the temple history of performance practice, and as Devadasis were actually providing a selective history at this point, one that did not refer to their social lifestyles, one that did not speak about their matrilineal inheritances, nor about their non-domestic sexuality as public women. So this was a departure. I'm going to summarize quickly. The moment of menuhin was with the establisher, with the formation of the Madras Music Academy. Newly founded national institutions such as the Madras Music Academy took their cue from Devadasis and idealized Devadasi dance practices as cultural and aesthetic performance, not as social practices associated with ancient temple history, worship, myth, and classical antiquity. Balasaraswati Devadasi dancers were presented on the Madras proscenium, and even as they were being presented, V. Raghavan was writing up the history, historiography of the dance. V. Raghavan, working as officer in the Madras Music Academy, provided the first official English language national oriental historiography for Sadir under the new name of Bharatanatyam. Raghavan used the name of Bharatanatyam polysemically, yeah? The name referred to Bharata, the author of the Natyashastra, to Bharat, the modern nation, and also to Bharatam, the Tamil dance teachers who taught Devadasi dancers. What Raghavan did was to inscribe Bharatanatyam within an indigenous Marga and Desi system of classification. Indira Peterson explains that Marga is usually described as that which is governed by country-wide common rules, i.e. that which is universal, whereas Desi is that which varies from place to place, i.e. the local or regional. Ragini Devi, writing in 1920, she was herself a dancer, an American dancer, explains that all dancing was classified by the Hindu masters, the teachers, as two kinds, which means in the performing practices there were two understandings of Desi and Margi. Margi, according to Ragini, and as it was told to her by the Hindu dancers, and I'm grateful to Devesh for giving me this citation, was dancing that was sacred to the gods and was performed only to the gods. Desi dancing, on the contrary, was performed at entertainments given before princes and assemblies, end quote. It was this Margi, or sacred history, that was emphasized in the Music Academy commentaries of the dance. Raghavan and others prioritized this. Devadasis performed, and it was the sacred history that was an ancient history, textual history, that was being provided alongside these performances. So this I mark as a moment of maneuver. The second maneuver was when Rukmini Devi entered the scene, and she saw the Devadasis presented at the Madras Music Academy. She heard the historiography. So she seized the symbols that were present in the historiography, and she replicated them visually in the performance practice. So for her debut in 1935, she seated her guru and his musical ensemble along the wings of the Western proscenium. And then, in 1937, she designed a temple stage using temple backdrops and front curtains with traditional imagery from the temple. In 1937, and after returning from her American tour, Rukmini Devi mounted the icon of Shiva Nataraja, the presiding deity of the Natyashastra, on a pedestal, placed him on one corner of the Western proscenium, and illumined him, who gave light to all, with oil lanterns and brass lamps, evoking links to Kathakali performance. She then lit what I describe as her temple stage constellation, comprising the three symbols of God, Guru, and temple, with an electrical spotlight that she imported from British stagecraft. Rukmini Devi was, in fact, the first dancer to stage the icon of Shiva Nataraja in his manifestation as Nataraja on the urban stage. Shiva Nataraja was not just a religious symbol associated with temple worship, but also a classical icon of high art, embodying principles of Indian abstraction and classicism, described so eloquently by A.K. Kumar Swami in his Dance of Shiva. Rukmini Devi explained her decision in this way, and I'm quoting, "Bharata's Natyashastra, for instance," she said, "can be traced to the great Rishi Bharata, and even before him we can trace it back to the splendor of Nataraja himself," end quote. She then enlarged the Sadi dance repertoire by choreographing new Tamil songs such as Natanamadinar, which extolled the beauty and grandeur of Shiva Nataraja's cosmic dance and danced it herself on the temple stage. In this way, Rukmini Devi inscribed her Shiva Nataraja icon within a Margi Desi conceptualization and elaborated choreographically on Raghavan's double reed historiography of Bharatanatyam. She explained, "In India, we have this magnificent conception of the Divine One, who himself is a dancer, a flute player, a cosmic dancer. The great being, Lord Nataraja himself, is a dancer, and so is Parvati and the Lord Sri Krishna, who danced in Vrindavan. Nowhere except in India is there such a cosmic conception of art," end quote. Rukmini Devi spoke about what she was doing in India in 1938 at Hollywood, California. In her speech entitled The Culture of India, Rukmini Devi explained how divinity is realized within the context of the temple stage in India and what she called the religious ceremonial. She explained, "In India, religion and classical dance are combined because both express the idea of creation, of rhythmic movement, of the influence of spirit upon matter. Religion is divinity expressed inwardly. Art is divinity expressed outwardly," end quote. Two women and a man, Balasaraswati, Rukmini Devi, and V. Raghavan, where working within the historiography of the dance provided by Raghavan. If Raghavan composed the first English language historiography of the representation, both women, one belonging to hereditary tradition and the other to a non-hereditary, visualized this temple concept in performance and put it on the national and international map through different embodiments of Bhakti in the 1930s and 40s. While Bala Saraswati was working in the national domain in the 1930s, Rukmini Devi was already working in the national and international in the 1930s. If Bala embodied Bhakti without the temple stage, Rukmini Devi embodied Bhakti within the theatrical constellation of the temple stage. Temple, tradition, history, historiography, these were the dominant metaphors through which the epistemic sort of historiography of Bharatanatyam was evolved. These frames actually were set in place in the first 5 years of the dance revival. In the paper that I circulated, I've described already how in the 1940s these symbols became traveling symbols and they were already leaving the territory of what was not at that time described as the nation, and as portable symbols and traveling symbols. So I'm not going to go through that. I'll just sort of get to the point here now. By the 1950s, after Indian independence, the Indian state established national academies to promote and support the arts. And around this time in the 1950s, the temple stage became hegemonic and exceeded anything imagined by Rukmini Devi. Dancers at this time, urban dancers, non-hereditary dancers, performing Bharatanatyam outside Kalakshetra, the institution that Rukmini Devi established, and used her temple stage constellation to celebrate their own linguistic and aesthetic vision of classical Bharatanatyam. While Kamala Lakshman, a well-known dancer, Bharatanatyam dancer based in South India, used the Shiva icon to dance Tamil songs, Yamini Krishnamurti, a dancer based in New Delhi, used the same icon to perform Sanskrit poems in praise of Shiva Nataraja. If Tamil-speaking dancers hail their hereditary teacher in his Tamil name as Natuvanar, Telugu-speaking dancers revered him in his Sanskrit name as Guru. One normative stage arranged picturesquely with historical symbols empowered urban dancers to speak differently on behalf of the three signposts of Bharatanatyam. This broad-based, multilingual inspiration is what Rukmini Devi gave to the 20th century dance revival. Elsewhere, I described how a regional, national, and international community gathered around the semiotic symbols of the Bharatanatyam stage, including dancing bows, icons of Shiva Nataraja, temple backdrops, and dance costumes. The new multilingual community that constituted itself around these symbols comprised urban dancers, gurus, devadasis, musicians, percussionists, dance scholars, dance anthropologists, dance critics, and theosophists residing both within and outside Kalakshetra, but extended beyond to embrace a larger, less visible community, including tailors, sculptors, cobblers, jewelers, flower vendors, electricians, and cameramen from the broader service sector. Bharatanatyam was able to use skills from an ever-widening pool of skilled professionals because the dance had been transformed, thanks largely to Rukmini Devi's cosmopolitan intervention in the dance revival, from an illegitimate regional dance practice into an upper-class, high-prestige, pan-Indian cultural activity. The expanding urban interest galvanizing around the Bharatanatyam representation enabled the articulation of what Benedict Anderson has described as an imagined community for the dance. Any socio-historical study of 20th century Bharatanatyam must recognize that it was the mechanical reproduction of the theatrical props associated with the dance, prefigured by temporal coincidence and measured by clock and calendar, which knit the dance community into an international community as early as the 1940s. The economic reproduction of the theatrical props inserted the dance work into an urban social ethos and also into what Walter Benjamin so famously described as the age of mechanical reproduction. Spectator in any part of the globe today can see the Bharatanatyam dancer dressed in traditional costume with ankle bells tied to her feet appear dramatically on the proscenium. She carries a bouquet of flowers in her hands. Rhythmically, she dances her way to the icon and places her offering of flowers at the feet of Shiva Nataraja. Then she glides gracefully towards her guru and pays homage to him. After two primary salutations, the dancer is free to take center stage. There she performs an elaborate salutation to the temple stage itself. God, Guru, and temple, transformed into historical stage props, thus manifested themselves as the three traveling signposts of Bharatanatyam. That's really, in short, what I wanted to say, but now I want to say what I did not want to say, but will say anyway. Who did not come through this temple stage in the 1950s? When we ask that question, and then, of course, Evesh will fill in on the rest of what I will not be able to say. Who did not come through this temple stage? And we have to say that it is the Devadasi, the temple dancer herself, who did not come through the very temple stage that was created for her enablement. So why did she not come through this stage? And then if we ask that question, of course, we'll have to look at the National Academies, which set up in the 1950s, while they were documenting performances, while they were providing support for the practitioners. They were more interested, it seems to me, in the hereditary teacher rather than the Devadasi herself. And they were not interested in the social lifestyles that I was talking with you about. So it was the aesthetic dance itself that the National Academies were interested in. So the Devadasis didn't come through because the National Academies couldn't, right? And the Devadasis at this time were also disappearing from the Madras Music Academy scene, and one Bala Saraswati was emerging, and the other Devadasis were disappearing. So there's this dialectical relationship between Bala and the other Devadasis. Behind Bala was tokenized in the national discourse, Bala Saraswati, and behind Bala Saraswati were 100,000 Devadasis who didn't get onto the temple stage and into the national or international discourse. Recently I heard a story that in the 1950s, told to me by B. Sundaram, who I met in Canada, that Devadasis in the 1950s, a group of them, six or seven Pandanallur Devadasis, actually went to the temple symbolically and officially disassociated themselves from the temple. This is a story which hasn't come into the dance discourse yet. I'm sure Devesh will write about it. And they actually gave away their bells and their nose rings and said, disassociated themselves from the dance and the temple. So these social stories are only now being recovered in the dance history. And this is also a post-1980s return to the Devadasi history. While this story of Devadasi is not important to us, maybe as cultural historians or even as dancers who are only interested in the form of the dance, feminist historians worry about this question of the Devadasi. For she was not a subaltern in the traditional sense of an Adivasi or a disenfranchised woman. She was a woman with great power at once upon a time in history. And this was a woman, according to feminist construction of the narrative, was a woman caught between tradition and modernity. She was a woman caught in the shuttle between tradition and modernity, a woman caught in the shuttle between brown and white patriarchy. And in this shuttle, she couldn't. She was lost, the woman, the figure was lost in this shuttle. And so this is the sort of the untold story, actually, as it were, of the Devadasi and the temple and the temple stage. And again, as I said, Sonia Jay will fill us up on that story. But to go on with the other story of Rukmini Devi, she, at the end of her life, she constructed a temple stage, which we saw. She was ill at this time, and Kapila Vatsyayan, who we were mentioning, thought at this time, the 1980s, that the dance had to be relocated from the temple stage to the temple site itself. So temple sites were opened up in the 1980s, and Kapila Vatsyayan explains, I felt it was time to relocate the dance in the precincts of the temple, to have dancers dance in the hall of the Chidambaram temple. When I spoke about my intention to Rukmini Devi, she was mad at me. Is this what I taught you all these years, Kapila? Was this what all this was about, to return the dance to the temple? You happen to be the vice president of Sangeet Natak Academy, and you can do it, but I shall not be seen dead anywhere near it. And of course she died. Rukmini Devi did not just speak against Vatsyayan's return initiative, but she rebutted it in action by building a magnificent site-specific temple theatre for Bharatanatyam. Known as Bharata Kalakshetra, Rukmini Devi's theatre stands on the 100-acre campus of Kalakshetra. Devi explained that although her theatre was conceived along the lines of the Kerala Kuthambalam, it would also have a temple atmosphere. She averred that, and I quote, dance was really the art of the temple, and that her temple theatre was built with that purpose in mind. It has many features of the temple, and we have adopted as much as possible all the ideals enshrined in the Natya Shastra, end quote. Why did Rukmini Devi construct this temple theatre in the final stage of the Bharatanatyam dance revival? Did she desire to rescue her temple stage aesthetic from historical oblivion, or was she memorializing the collective history of the temple stage in which three generations of urban dancers had danced through the 50-year period of the dance revival? Or was hopefully they were returning in the last moment of the dance revival, returning us, the dance historian, myself, to the 1927 moment of trauma, where the temple became, it was foregrounded as an epistemological and historical metaphor. I think I'll end here.
Thank you very much.